to the FTN Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host for the Bella Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined tonight by Val Huffafinger.
Paul Murphy!
Dude, thanks. We're actually recording on a Saturday morning.
No, it's tonight. It's late.
Oh, sorry.
I'm missing the Raptors.
Wednesday night, it's our normal recording. We definitely have not delayed recording to a different day because life has gotten in the way.
No, at this point in time, the Golden State Warriors still have a chance.
Oh, the show must go on. Oh, hockey stuff going on?
Hockey?
Yeah.
Who cares about hockey?
Okay.
Basketball.
I know some people do, you know. Well, not that I know. That's where my knowledge of hockey ends, by the way, that some stuff is going on or was going on.
Yeah, how are the Thrashers doing?
Oh, man, don't bring that up. I used to love going down to this. I try to get down to sporting events once or twice a year and going to the, thankfully, kind of blessed where I am of having a lot of really cool events. I used to love going down to watch the Thrashers play.
Are they the Jets now? Is that the Thrashers?
They're in Canada somewhere.
Yeah, they're Winnipeg now. That's actually, honestly, if you guys had to sacrifice for a team to go somewhere, like Winnipeg, that's just, you know, that's a great kindness to the people of Winnipeg.
Okay.
People of Atlanta, just know that it went to a good place.
Good home.
I mean, not the best home, but a loving home.
Okay, nice. All right. I've been traveling a lot. That's why, you know, stuff got in the way. But I'm back home. I don't have any foreseeable travel plans for a while. So I really appreciate everyone's patience with us with a little bit of irregularity in the show's release. I promise I'll make it up to, you know, all the listeners. I have another couple of guests that I'm trying to line up. The schedules haven't been able to collide yet. And to the sponsors, you know, the people that support the show. And that way, definitely going to make sure they get made up too.
Hey, Paul, we all appreciate what you're doing. And also, I myself am a little relieved that you, you know, you have a job. Because, you know, when I was a listener, I was like, how is this guy doing this?
I go to work every day. And at night, by night, I'm a podcaster.
That's right.
Contrast Paints going up for pre-order, I think, today.
Cool as heck.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, people, you get these people with these reactions, and until I actually see them in my own hands, I'm going to reserve judgment, but really excited, so get them in now, because I think they're going to be very popular. So if you're on the fence about ordering even one or two colors, I definitely suggest that you go ahead and get that order in.
I am fortunate to, you know, commission out a lot of the stuff that I, all the good stuff. You know, that's pretty nice models. I don't trust with myself. I commission it out and I just don't paint regularly enough. But as you know, I can paint grots and, you know, I'll paint boys. And when I do that, I do a pre-shade with an airbrush, you know, a black base, gray highlight, white highlight, zenithal. And then I use washes and then I do a highlight. Mm-hmm. And so my painting process is already essentially the contrast process. And if these things are designed a little bit better to flow a little better, you know, settle more nicely and, you know, can be wet blended. People are hating on them. Need to get on YouTube and look at what some of the more advanced skill sets are doing with the paints, because I think there's a lot of room for really cool stuff to be done with them. So to me, I think they're fantastic in concept because that's how I like to paint. And, you know, least amount of effort with the most amount of result.
Well, I paint for friends sometimes, you know, so I see it as like, you don't always break out your best wine, but when a bunch of company comes over, maybe you break out a wine and maybe that contrast paints fits into that.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're right now, like what they're showing is like the absolute lowest barrier to entry. Here's what you can do with it. Just slap it on the model. And then, boom, you got a model, which honestly, as far as barriers to entry to this game, like I remember when I found out, like as a child, like, oh, they don't come painted. You know, that's a gut check, right? Like, am I going to keep going with this? And I think for a lot of people, it's just a non-starter. So if it can be made to appear as easy as, heck, you know, you could get one color that gives them some depth and, you know, like the ultramarine, which they're always showing, which, yeah, no, it doesn't look amazing. Like a, you know, wet blended or highlight ultramarine, but neither do most people's. And it probably looks a little bit better than the like rattle can ultramarine blue guy. And it looks a lot better than gray plastic. So yeah, I think contrast is great and clearly supported. And as people innovate with it, get it in their hands and do cool stuff, it's a tool that I think will rapidly become very useful.
Yeah, more to come on that probably next week as I get my hands on them and try them out. Really can't wait. Well, this episode, I know I want to talk a little bit about your list. You've actually had some it's always a little bit of an up and down emotional journey with you, Val.
Yes, no, it is all on my sleeve. That's right. It is an up and down emotional journey. No, I've been having a lot of fun with my orc list. I've been running a decreasing amount of Meganops, but only to fit in some other pieces. So still triple battalion. I've got one big unit of 10, and then either a unit of 6 or 8 Meganops as the second unit. And then supporting characters, I've swapped in some index choices because I'm not bound by ETC stuff anymore. So I've been trying out the Warboss on bike. I tried out Mega Armor Warboss, who is my hero. I love that guy. He's really awesome. But you know,
that's going to the index, right?
Yeah, he's out of the index. He's like a 40-point premium. He's like 120 points, I want to say. 122 if he's got the custom shooter. And but he's a 2-up save. You know, he's toughness, you know, 5, maybe 6. No, he's toughness 6. But he's got 7 wounds, so he's got an extra wound. Same amount of attacks. Which just means that he doesn't automatically die after he swings in combat, which is really, really nice sometimes. And he's a bit tanky. He also buffs, because he's an index choice, a little gamey, but hey. He buffs all clans for breaking heads. And I'm pretty sure for the Waw as well. So he's not restricted by clan like some of the Codex Warboss would be.
As we get deeper and deeper into this edition, I get less and less comfortable suggesting index choices.
I don't.
Let me caveat that. That's just it. That's the couch for what I'm going to say. I think that the Ambot is an amazing source of bits to make your war boss in Mega Armor.
Well, you know what? I think the Gazgul just needs, like, you got to go third party for Gazgul because, like, the actual Gazgul is you know, just a slightly larger Mega Knob. And so I think that's a perfect Mega Armor war boss. So I did a head swap on him. He's a Blood Axe Mega Armor war boss with a nice beret. He looks cool. He's totally not Gazgul. So I've been sort of like tinkering in the margins. It still has the 15 Ludas. It's got 15 Tank Bustas. It's got 90 Grots, 2 Weird Boys. And I've been running, I started with 3 Shock Attack Guns, one of being the Relic and Azdef Skulls. And the Relic guy is the War Boss, the Warlord. So that way he can get Big Kill a Boss. And that combo right there is amazing because Big Killer Boss gives +1 to wound vehicles and monsters. So in most matchups, that's a very handy thing to have in your toolkit. But one thing about the list that I didn't actually realize as it was happening. I was at Atomic Empire and I was drunk with power. I thought this list is still, despite my record, I'm probably around 500 over, say, 20 games with it right now. It's still, to me, the most powerful and effective list I've ever run competitively. So it's a lot of fun for me in that way. But the variance on it is crazy. So, you know, with a shock attack gun, it can go from, you know, not being able to, you know, being able to one shot a knight to, you know, not being able to kill a Gretchen, you know, in essentially, you know, the same shooting phase if you're shooting it twice. You know, Ludas, now that you have to roll each time you shoot them for the amount of shots that they have, there's a higher degree of variance in them. Meganobs themselves, they hit on 4s. So there's a big spread of how that result can come. Sometimes they might, you know, get, you know, they probably get the 12 or 13 hits as many times as they might get the, you know, 7 or 8 hits, you know, if there's, you know, 20 attacks for whatever reason. So like, it's a lot of swings in it. And, you know, I played a guy named Jamie my final round of Atomic Empire. And I was losing my mind over my dice. And, you know, again, I played in an RTT and I was playing a really good friend of mine named Alex Stewart. And he, you know, I couldn't hit clutch dice rolls. I couldn't make rolls where, you know, even average would have sufficed. The variance was just coming, you know, in moments where I kind of needed something to happen, I would get nothing. At Atomic Empire, I had a shooting phase where Mortarion was on 8 wounds and I had all my shock attack guns, all my Ludas shoot him and didn't deal a wound. I barely got a handful of hits.
That is a heartbreaker.
I've shot the shock attack gun in my game against Alex and I did the double shot and I got 8 and 9 shots respectively. And I got strength 11 and strength 12. So I rolled 11 in boxcars, which means any hit is mortal wound. 0 hits. I'm running these guys, the shock attack guns, by the way, everybody, like a lot of people like to run them as bad moons. I think this is folly. You got to run them as death skulls, gives them a free to hit, to wound, and damage roll. Like single model weapons are amazing as Death Skulls because of the power that that adds to them. And even with that, you know, fail to hit once on two shots with the Relic. So those swings, and I really would love to do, maybe I'll reach out to the Variance Hammer guy and just to get him to do an analysis of what the spread is like on these weapons. Because I don't
Eric's
know.
If great. That's right up his alley, by the way. So.
Yeah, because I don't know if necessarily what my experience was really was that far off of what my expected results should have been, right? So if my I think I really need to adjust my expectations and get a lot more zen about the way the dice go, because I've been, I don't know if it's necessarily uncharacteristically upset about my dice, but it has definitely demonstrated to me that I need to be way more chill about my dice, because you know, things are just gonna, you know, they're gonna come and they're gonna go, and when you have something that is, as you know, RNGE, you know, random number generator driven as some of these key pieces in this work list, you know, you got to be cool to ride with the highs and the lows.
Yeah, so. You do. But that streaking, that variance, I mean, sometimes, what do I ask for? Like, I just need average dice going into this tournament and I think I'll do all right. But, you know, sometimes you don't get it, but you actually have to know what that real average dice is. Like, if you are expecting the average, like in your mind, if the average is something else, not average.
Yeah.
It's going to skew what your idea of the performance is.
It's also a range of probabilities, which is what I'd really love to see, right? So, like, a shock attack gun is on average, what it would be, 7 shots, strength 7. And, you know, what's that? It's probably 2 hits, probably maybe 3 with Death Skulls, right? Yeah. That's the average. That's not, your mileage may vary from that, right? So what is 80% of the time, what does a shock attack gun do? What is the range
of? I don't even know that it's 3 hits with, cause you only get the 1 reroll. I think it's probably still two something. Well, I mean, hits.
7 shots, you know, you'd hit on a third of them. Yeah,
you might. I mean, look, anyway, I'm illustrating the point.
Also, on that example where I shot twice, this is something that I thought about later. So if you took the whole pool of dice that I rolled, and granted, it's not a massive amount of dice, but it still kind of demonstrates something. So I had 8 plus 9 shots, 17, you know, to hit rolls. But I also rolled, what would it be? 4, another 8 dice to just determine the stats, right? Because it'd be 4 dice on each. So, so it's 25 dice on which I did roll 4, 5, or 6s. So, but they just weren't any of the to hit ones. So, you know, I did roll under, but in that pool of dice, it wasn't necessarily that heartbreakingly off average. And if you think about rolling like, if you roll super hot in that first, you know, 4 set of dice with a shock attack gun, you know.
11 like, shots, strength 11.
Yeah.
7 hits.
Well, you may or may not get those 7 hits. You know, so I don't know. 2 things. You can either look at your list, and I think this is what a lot of good competitive players probably do, is look at your list and where are the fail points? How much are we giving to the gods of variance here? And I think there are orc builds, and you saw it last weekend, much less variance dependent. And those are things that are built, I think, largely around rolling buckets of dice centered on boys and infantry. With some of the variants, sprinkled in there, still running. Like there was, one guy, Chuck, he won, a tournament out in Washington, and he was running, I think, around 120 boys. You know, he still had 3 shock attack guns. He ran them all as Death Skulls. But the core of his list, he had no Ludas. So the core of his list was just investing CP into what his boys could do.
Mm-hmm.
You have Simon Pritis out in the UK. He has always just run almost purely boys and storm boys. You know, I think he had 150, maybe 160 models. And again, no Ludas, not even double battalion, not even triple. So he's able to invest all that CP into what the infantry can do. And if you can hustle with that list, if you can play that list on time, on target, you're going to have much more consistency in your dice. You're going to have less variance because you're rolling so much and they're also, you know, not needing such high numbers to hit.
I like that. That's actually one of the things that make the guard so strong is that the number of actual stratagems you're concerning yourself with is so minimum. I mean, it's no more than 5. And that it just becomes part of a natural extension of what you do every single round. You yourself have more consistency in what you deliver.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm I still really like Mike Corcoran's concept. I'm actually thinking about...
Well, let me talk about this for a second, if you don't mind. So you've been playing this list for quite some time, or some variation of the orcs, and you've been trying to find whatever that sweet spot of the perfect number of this unit, that unit, or whatever. And that is the journey that everyone should take as they refine their list. And it's easy when there's a good unit. So when we talked about the Meganovs were great, it's pretty easy to go into, whatever your army program is, or Excel or whatever, and say, I would like the maximum number of these units because I've determined that they're good. Give me as many of them as I can possibly fit and roll with it. Doesn't care how many points it is, whatever. I just want a lot of what's good and move on. And so I'm going to get wins, right? Well, not always.
Yeah. Not quite, eh?
Well, but that leads to the next step is like, when do you start tweaking? When you play a sample size of games, whatever, that sometimes it just takes the one to go, nope.
Like, how's that triple super heavy working out?
Well, okay, pretty well. I don't know that that's the best example because it seems to actually pretty be strong in this. I don't know that it's going to be what I end up taking, to the ATC,
which could be a good ATC list. That's for sure.
Yeah. But I think I'm going to play coming up for the Master City 40K tournament on June 22nd, which is the second round of the Armageddon series as well, which I want to talk about with you just a little bit as we get deeper into the show. But for the Master City, again, June 22nd, please come out and support that. That's a really cool format, too. I think I'm going to be absolutely blisteringly exhausted at the end of it, but I bet it's going to make for an awesome set of stories.
Is it an Iron Man?
Yeah, 5 rounds in 1 day.
Oh, I love that. So it goes past midnight, though, so still is it still a PT?
It has to, and it's also in a brewery.
Oh, amazing. Guys, go to this tournament. I would like, how many points?
2,000. Yeah, so it's...
What? You guys are doing a 2,000-point Ironman? That's serious. Usually these are not full points. And
I better check on the points, but I feel like it's 2,000, and it's yeah,
that's real.
It's gonna be good times. So I'm taking what I think is what would be my tournament version of this list. In that, but and I don't want to get away from your point you're making with how you've adjusted the number of Meganobs and or Ludas and stuff in your list. But I've had a similar path with super heavies and vultures and Ogryn, even like how many Ogryn do I really need? Like it's real easy for me to say, oh, I absolutely have to have 9 Ogryn.
Yeah.
And this is not a painting choice. Like the Ogryn are sitting there. I mean, I just finished them recently. I have 9 of them, but do I really need 9 or should I start trimming out an Ogryn or two here, a vulture or two there to really give me more about what it takes to win more games consistently? But sorry, go ahead, Bob.
I think all I was going to say is actually the core components of my list have really remained quite static and the same. And that's the Meganobs get all the attention. And I keep saying my list. This is based on someone called Liam Hackett, who's a very good player on the ETC team in Australia. He's been running this basically all season is what he's been doing. All ITC season, he's been running this list. And his list is basically not changed. So he's run it very, very consistently and he hasn't really lost much, but probably a little higher caliber player. For me, I've been having fun in the margins of it. So I haven't really changed any of the like core components or pieces. But for me, for example, I realized that if I compromised on 20 Meganobs and I went down to 18, well, I can have characters that are a little bit more, punchy or offer some more auras. Or I can squeeze in that extra shock attack gun or, whatever. It's very, very much in the margins. But fundamentally, the list has not changed in its operation. I tried out a different chapter tactic on the Meganobs, a different clan. I went to from Evil Sons to Death Skulls. So these types of things, and then back to Evil Sons, which I think is still the right choice. That's the original choice. So, yeah, I haven't completely scrapped it and done something that plays alarmingly different. Just really looking to see, are there optimized pieces, especially when you have access to those index characters and things like that for orcs. It doesn't really change the overall dynamic of the list, but maybe makes it a little sharper in certain places. And so that's kind of the fun I've been having with it, but ultimately sticking to the same core because I know it's a successful formula. That's one of the nice things about netlisting. And recently there's another topic about netlisting. I think that starting from netlisting, I think for most players is a really, really great place. And then, playing the margins, find the...
That was one of the topics of our show, last week.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it bad? And I think the answer to that is no, it's absolutely not. Not bad. bad. I mean, this is a personal journey for a lot of people because, you know, you spend so much time on an effort. I mean, you got to buy the models, you got to put the models together, you got to paint them. I mean, like, so people are going to have different opinions on what you should be doing with your hobby time. But it, really what it comes down to, what do you want? And if supercharging that part, the list building phase or whatever, if you want to get some inspiration from others, go for it.
Yeah. And to get to another point, just about tweaks and I guess coming in from, expectations you may have. Like I said, I was drunk with power in my test games before my first tournament with this list. I thought it was really fantastic and awesome. And then I got really, I think they have a term. It's on tilt about my dice. And it did allow me to get distracted from probably the real reasons why I was losing games, right? So levels of aggression that I was going in with my tank busters, for example. Tank busters have a really short range, right? So, but they have incredible hitting power, for orcs. You know, they reroll hits against vehicles, which there's a lot more of them around now. Because they're bad moons, they reroll ones, even if they're shooting, like, say, a Primarch or something. They're strength 8, they do flat 3 damage, there's 15 of them, and they can be jumped in anywhere. So I was using them almost without fail as a trade in, like, the initial turn or two of the game. And I was gunning for first turn so I could do that, go in and take out, a key model or whatever. And I played a lot of games. I want to say, at least 8 games before I was able to stop and reflect that, I'm trading this unit early with an army that, for the most part, is quite hard to attack, right? So because, I have a lot of Grot, you can get a lot of the Grot units if I leave them out. But the core units, the Ludas, are very well protected for a turn or two. The Meganobs are small footprint. They can hide in buildings or behind line of sight blocking. There's a lot of things where most of the key components of the army, the tank busters, can literally just be either in a teleporta or they can be on the back line as far away as possible from high volume shooting. A lot of times I was taking first turn where second turn would be way more advantageous. If you can survive a hit in 40K, if your list is able to, second turn, almost in any format, is far more advantageous. ITC, ETC, you're able to know what your opponent's objectives are, how many units they've killed of yours. You know what your targets are. You know what, how many objectives you need to score. Whatever. You name it, there's probably a benefit to going second. So if you can take the punch, take the punch. And don't always be hyper-aggressive. And I think because I was drunk with power and mad at my dice, I failed to notice the fact that I was just being way too aggressive early game, which is a classic, thing with this list. Actually, I played a league game the other day, and I held back. I held back, and I actually brought the Magnobs in third turn. I brought the Tank Busters in, I think maybe even the third turn as well. So it was a much more relaxed, reacting to my opponent, because I didn't need to get up there. He was playing AdMech with Gallants and stuff. He had to come to me. Yeah,
I don't see this holding shooting. Back. I see that as more trying to be a lot more tactical, to try to really diagnose maybe what might have been some missteps in other games.
Right. And really what I would have, like, the story, if you had asked for the hot take, I would have only talked about dice, right out of the gate. I would have been like, I don't want to talk about dice, but here's how my dice screwed me. And that really isn't the truth. I think there's a lot of stuff that can be, when you're going into a game, if you think, you always have bad dice, or if there's stuff that you're always hung up on about why you lose, well, step back and really think about, what are your opening gambits? What do you usually set up to do? What is your list super strong at? What are you always afraid of? What do you think absolutely has to happen in that first turn? And then ask yourself, does it actually have to happen? Like, yeah, it's probably a good idea to kill Magnus first turn, but do you really need to kill Mortarion? I think in a lot of cases you don't. There's, that kind of thinking, I think, is something that, takes a little bit of a cooler head prevailing and taking a little step back. And, where I am at the level of this game, I really love playing 40K, and I hate, I really love having a good time with my opponent. And there were just times where I was getting super, salty for reasons that were actually in my control and probably made for an uncomfortable experience, at least as I'm throwing my hat down and saying, "Fooey."
You don't really get that way during the game. You're actually very pleasant to play against.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think it looks silly, and I'm a dramatic guy, and I don't think anyone thinks I'm about to flip a table. But nonetheless, it's just like, it's, there's a very large baby having a bit of a baby moment, and I don't want that. Like, it's like, sometimes you might have a few too many beers or too much to drink, and you talk too loudly, and you tell jokes you think are super funny. You wake up the next day and you're like, no, that wasn't a good look. That didn't feel good. So, you know, when you get really upset about playing minis and you know, you're not your best self because some random number generators didn't roll your way. Well, you know, step back and think, how could have you done things differently so that you didn't need to make that dice roll?
Yeah.
And that's the key. And that can get clouded by all kinds of things. Oh, I didn't get first turn. You know, that's why I hear a lot, you know, especially amongst casual players, is like, whoever goes first wins. Okay. Well, why is that happening? You know, and because you're emotional about it and it's something that seems like it's out of control, and that's the problem. You know, it's hard sometimes to even realize that, well, hold on, maybe it's because I'm deploying way too far forward or whatever it might be. So sometimes that sober second look and reflection on the game has to come way later once you've chilled out a little bit. And I think that's the fun of getting good at a technical skill is, you know, being able to step back and look at the mistakes you made. And then, you know, for a lot of us, we're just going to go out and make a different mistake, and that's cool. But
that's not a bad thing, right? I mean, no. As long as you kind of, fail forward. Yeah. You know, really? I mean, and that's kind of a topic I'd like to talk about. And it's something maybe we may explore over the next series of shows is like how to stop rehearsing failure.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically how to change a little bit of the things along the way to be successful. Even if you make a different mistake, it's still a different mistake. And that's okay. You know, but not to do, I mean, you kind of went on, you know, a bit of a riff about it, but like, don't be so quick to blame the dice because the dice are only a part of it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, sometimes games do come down to that one dice roll, and that's a great game if you happen to be in that situation, right?
But oh, man, y'all remember those times when, like, when leadership was, oh, if I just pass morale here, then I've won this game, max points. If I fail it, then I'm tabled or whatever. You know, that's why we play.
Rich Kilton, one of the best orc players. I think he's leading the ITC right now. He took Index Orcs out for one last ride. And what was that? It may have been SoCal. I think it was SoCal. And he was sitting on something like, I want to say 4-0. Maybe he was 3-1 with Index Orcs. And it came down to a dice roll, which was a morale test, and he lost it. Forgot a special rule he had, which on a 6 would have allowed his knob to stay on the board, and he wound up losing the game. But yeah, it just comes down to that moment for all moments of glory sometimes. You know,
which is cool.
I mean, how many bounces will the ball have before it drops through the hoop and Kawhi settles to the ground in euphoria? It was 4.
Yeah, there you go. Well, what I'm saying is, like, the dice will decide a game sometimes. Yeah, especially when if everything has been played perfectly, the only variance is the dice. But how often is that really what's happening? And you were talking about changing the list around, and I know we've kind of jumped from list to dice to whatever. But you know, in actual fact, there are things that you can look at in your list that maybe are not playing as well. Or maybe a choice that you want to make for things like you mentioned Footprint of Meganobs earlier, and that got me kind of into a thought process of the footprints of units and how we can sometimes use those to win more games. And so when we're thinking about like missions to where you have to control a certain amount of objectives or, you know, a table quarter or whatever, having units on the table, I'm not suggesting that bikes are really great in every list that can take bikes, but, you know, maybe if you find like in your Chaos Space Marine list to where you're not able to control enough of the table to keep people from getting into certain sections or to touch enough units that you encounter in your opponent's thing or tanks or whatever, you know, bikes have that wide base.
Yeah.
And that's a much a part of the game. The base size of things is as much a part of the game as maybe what you even put in your list.
Yeah. Well, it works. You know, the 32 versus 25 millimeter thing. That's a big difference.
Well, it's a hot topic. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, I'm not going to tell you how to base. Oh, I don't care if it's your old base, or I really don't care what base size the model's on. I mean, like when we're talking about all games being played perfectly, that base size, it could be make or break.
It's tough. I mean, I would say I've made the move for aesthetic reasons first and foremost, but also so I don't have to argue about it. But I also think that there are benefits and there are negatives to having a larger or smaller base.
Well, I don't necessarily want to discuss, you know, why to rebase or whatever. Take that completely out of the equation.
It's not binary. Like what I'm trying to say there is like a small base is not necessarily always better than a larger base. A larger base is not necessarily always better than a smaller base. And I think as a result, it's probably better if we had things standardized a little bit, like they do in Sigmar. That will come. Until then, much like the index, play as the rule is.
Yeah, you can actually make some tactical decisions based on your base size and what you might need as a part of your army. That's where I'm going. Now, I don't mean take it as the base size as it comes. I'm not talking about no base manipulation is being discussed here. If you feel like you need a larger footprint, there may be some options in your army that allow for that, or vice versa. You feel like you need a smaller footprint, like, oh man, this unit sounds really cool, but there's nowhere for me to hide it, or I can't go upstairs or something like that, you know.
Most amazing footprint I ever played with was the Achilles strong point with the missiles on it. And you know, in your deployment zone, depending on what deployment map you got, it could hold two objectives because it's just so wide, you know. And you know, it's model, so it's zoned out this huge, you know, piece of board space, you know, like 9 inches away from it. It was a fantastic piece for those reasons. Just its footprint alone, it's pretty expensive, but you know, I had a lot of fun with it, and a lot of the reason why I really enjoyed it was its footprint. You know, a unit of boys could embark it on one side and then disembark it on the other, and it just doubled their movement.
Doubled,
you know, over two turns.
Oh yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah.
But it's you know, stuff like that. Yeah, there are all kinds of neat little things in the margins, and just sort of to pull it back to like that, the question of base size, especially when you're starting with a netlist base, like a nice, delicious netlist. You're probably starting with that netlist because someone did well with it. Right. So and you hear this on podcasts all the time. So people think they can take a netlist to a tournament and suddenly they're going to win the tournament, and then they don't. And then they don't, because the pilot skill is what makes that thing sing. Right. So if you have like this high powered list and it's not going well for you, reach out to somebody who has had success with your high powered netlist, or has maybe you snowflaked a few choices because you thought they were better, but you know, you didn't realize why those choices were made in that particular list. You know, reach out or read articles. Like, a lot of the main archetypes are discussed in detail all over the place online. There's lots of places you can go for quality information, because it's probably more in how you're using the tools rather than the actual toolbox. We focus so much on, you know, what clubs are in your bag rather than, you know, how you hit the shots. And so I think for me, it was, I was getting a bit frustrated with not even the clubs in my bag, but, you know, how the ball was bouncing. whereas I just needed to take a step back and look at actually how I was playing, even though I thought, you know, I was doing the right moves, you know, maybe I wasn't. And I was, and I think that's a key thing, especially when you have a netlist that has success been demonstrated. Look at what are the variables. Where has it had success? What types of formats? What types of terrain? One big thing I think I've discovered about the Megnobs list is that it thrives in a sort of FLG enclosed ruin, aka magic box environment, where you can get them into a protected place. Same thing as Bulgrim, get them into some place where they cannot be touched, and they own that part of the table, you know, barring indirect fire. But whereas I've been playing in a lot of tournaments without, you know, enclosed ruins, or really even like really, you know, ruins on more than two sides, you know, mostly L ruins is what I've been playing in. So that makes them a bit more vulnerable to things spinning around and shooting them and all kinds of stuff. They're not able to hold space like they could if they had the magic box. So that was something I didn't really consider. And it doesn't mean that the list doesn't work in the environment I'm playing, but it would need to be played differently. So, but this game is so, there's a thousand permutations.
Let's take a quick break. We will come back and we will discuss some of exactly what you're talking about right now.
Oh, right on.
See ya.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
And we are back. Still got Val Hufflefinger.
Still.
When we broke a second ago, we were talking about things like terrain types and stuff, and these are not necessarily things that you can control when you are traveling. And so, you know, that's, I feel like maybe that is something that you should try to get some advanced information on, especially if they are using some of these rules, like people call the magic boxes and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a massive factor. I think there's two recent events where it really came in big, and that was where terrain style shifted dramatically. The first would be the ETC I attended last year, in Croatia. So ETC, if you look at old photos, year to year, ETC doesn't have the same organizing committee. It's kind of like the Olympics. So every year, ETC is started from scratch. And if you understand the scale of that event, it's not just Warhammer 40K. It's a bunch of different things. And every year, they kind of source terrain independently of the previous tournament. There's no, like, there's no warehouse somewhere that the ETC terrain lives. And last year, I know they communicated it, but very quietly. They were communicating the type of terrain that was going to be on the tables. And they brought really cool sort of, they mass produced these pre-printed, basically ruin Ls. You know, none of them ever had any openings on the bottom floor. So there's lots of like ground floor line of sight blocking because they didn't use the ITC rule at the time. And there was just a lot of terrain on the tables. Whereas I think previous years in ETC, they were used to a lot more, even the terrain dense tables were actually fairly open. And then again, Adepticon had notoriously sort of out of fashion, sort of fifth edition style terrain up until this year.
I mean, this year, yeah, it was much better this year.
Yeah, and then players came and suddenly there was a lot of line of sight blocking, a lot of density on the tables. And that is a shift. Or even LVO, you know, just use another example. LVO, people really anticipated, you know, magic boxes everywhere. Reese was saying, look, there's a lot of tables that don't have these enclosed ruins. Some of them only have one, you know, et cetera, et cetera. People came expecting to always be able to jump into one. And that wasn't the case. You know, there's a lot of Tau players who, you know, a lot of players who thought maybe I should have brought a Tau to the LVO. Maybe they would have had a better chance. So whether or not a table is open or closed off, or like, so just lots of line of sight blocking versus enclosed ruins. So line of sight blocking does not equal enclosed ruins. These can change really which armies do very well. In the ITC, you see a lot of, I'd say, toolsy lists with lots of infantry, things that can take advantage of a lot of the different terrain features that are out there, versus in some formats, you might see like the all-out shooting lists winning a lot of the time. And perhaps if you looked and saw what was actually on the tables, you'd see either a lot more area terrain or a lot less line of sight blocking terrain. So scouting ahead and trying to get a grip on and trying not to be surprised by the density and style of terrain is a really, really handy thing. And a lot of these events have lasted for years now, and there's no reason why you can't go check out a cool gallery of games in progress from the previous year and see what types of stuff is out there.
Yeah, or ask around. You can get some local. I mean, most people, if you are traveling to an event, especially going outside of your element, you're going to find a few people who are very keen to talk about what that is. I mean, this is, you know, we are, of course, focused on the community side, but it's a living, breathing thing out there. People will communicate with you and tell you what's up.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, this is one of the reasons, it's hard for me. I know orcs fairly well. I know a lot of the dominant builds. But, I mean, there are some all-in shooting builds, you know, like the 18 mech guns, which you haven't really seen anyone, I think, try in any earnestness. Because it just wouldn't work if it was on a dense, stable terrain. Just, you know, needs line of sight, that kind of stuff. But if you were going to something with a lot of open tables, or maybe player-placed terrain, that's another wrinkle that appears every now and again, where the players place the terrain before the game begins. Then you can start thinking, like, maybe I do go all in on shooting, you know, or whatever the angle may be, what archetype you decide to go with.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to talk about. And before we, you know, get too far off the mark here, you know, we were talking about things that to change up your list. So things that that should factor into your list is what the tools that you need to win the game or smooth out some of that variance in your list. The actual maneuvering on the table can matter. It can matter a big time. I mean, like, you have to look at it. It's like, oh, I can never get out of my table quarter. Well, I hate to say it, no matter how shooty your list is, it's probably bad.
Yeah, if it can't move at all.
Yeah, or if it has trouble getting even up to midfield or into your opponent's deployment zone or whatever. Now, of course, missions factor into this, but I'm talking about things that largely use ITC-style missions, or things where, like, progressive objectives or missions to where some of your scoring is completely based on your ability to get somewhere and sit, you know, or kill something. I mean, that's basically the two core concepts of the game.
Yeah. It's very rare that you can have a fully undynamic list and win. I mean, there are some mission sets out there that are very Eternal War based, so where you don't have to move maybe until late game. But even then, I mean, like, when you are facing a lot of end game scenarios rather than being purely progressive, you know, you got to be setting yourself up to be in position to do those things. So, you know, you have to be able to still anticipate where you need to be and make sure that you can get there.
Well, there was a time a couple of editions ago where you could just be like, I'm just going to pack every single gun in here. I'm just going to win games. But the missions, the game has evolved, the defense of things has evolved. Like the game is not necessarily conducive to that all the time. And so that, you know, when you're making your list, like even me, man. Like, I recently was like, my list has all the guns. It is going to be amazing. Like, oh man, if I just spent 100 points on Scions, then I flip these games. I would have maxed out my opponent instead of him and maxing me out. Like, with just 100 point change
in my list. Or even how you use the units. So, for example, I've been running the big unit of Meganobs and a smaller unit, like 6-man, and usually 6 or 8. And usually that unit is sort of in the reserves, aka just sort of chilling in the back, waiting for, you know, where it needs to go. Well, what better use for them could there be than just engineers? Like, they were surviving multiple turns, chilling. And it took me how many games to even realize that, hey, I could have had these guys as engineers the whole time, you know? So, you know, it's changes in mission set, like ITC, I was prepping a lot in ETC format and recently started playing ITC again. And I guess a lot of the post LVO changes were sort of lost on me. So, you know, going back and really looking at the format, what can your list do in this format? Like you said, does that 100 points of Scions get you behind enemy lines consistently? You know, whatever it might be. You know, or what tools and lists do you have to meet these objectives? What are you vulnerable to? There's all kinds of mental thought games you can do that aren't just like rolling out the shooting phase on average dice, which is what I think a lot of people spend their time obsessing about, which is a lot of fun, imagining just blowing your opponent away.
Or if I find myself like, let's say I want to screen a particular unit. I may not always like just having 10 or 30, 25 millimeters, you know, because maybe I'm only putting this unit into screen for one turn if I need it, but then I could never get to XYZ place on the board. But if I throw in some bikes or some, Fiends of Slaanesh or, you know, or the Seekers or whatever, something like that in my list, then I get the benefit of that wide base screen. And then I still get to move across the field if I want to. I mean, these are just choices that I think you should consider more often.
So if you listen to Don Hoosen talk about his purge list, he's got 3 Helldrakes in there, right? And the rest is like Lord Discordance and Derridaeo Dreadnoughts and Contemptor Dreadnoughts and maybe a few other things. But it looks like a list that's just going to stand there. Certain things run at you, the rest of things shoot at you, and seems really binary. But he's got these 3 generally regarded as awful units in there that have crazy range, big footprints, and to him are keys to his list, right? So to him, he thinks that that's really what makes it go, because they're things that he's going to throw in your face and you don't want to have to deal with them, but you have no choice, right? So
this is
the Helldrakes, yeah. Because even if a Helldrake doesn't kill something, it can, you know, lock it in combat, it can get in the way, it can do all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, and I don't think it's a flyer. So, yeah, I think you can move block with them. I think it's just interesting that this sort of sparked it. So if you're like net listing Don Hoosen's list, you might look at it and say, well, these Helldrakes are garbage. They've been garbage since day one. And that might be the first thing you cut. Whereas it might be the thing that lets the rest of your army get upfield and take board control. Otherwise, you might get stuck in your deployment zone because you got to be hiding behind stuff.
Yeah, they are a flyer. The Helldrakes are a flyer.
But I mean, aircraft keyword, because they don't have a minimum move, do they?
They do not.
Yeah. So, yeah, there you go. So I don't think that they suffer the... Is aircraft the thing that has the bases don't block?
I think you're right.
Yeah. So yeah, there you go. So you can still move block with a Helldrake, which is pretty cool. Anywho.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Like making a choice for like, oh, I need XYZ thing to happen. I mean, it's like, what's that movie? Moneyball?
Yeah.
You know, where they go and they're trying to pick players on a baseball team. And instead of just looking at whatever a big name baseball player is and saying we need to throw money at that, they go, oh, we need somebody who can do X thing. We need someone who consistently gets to second base.
Yep.
Or whatever. And then finding that. Find what's the cheapest guy that can do that?
Yeah. A data driven process. Or you can even look at, you know, what am I absolutely.
No, don't nerd this up, Val.
No, I was going to say, well, I mean, Moneyball is essentially the story of, you know, spreadsheet and nerds. But no, I think you're hitting on a really cool analogy here, which is, you know, I think a lot of folks will want to play you know, their dudes, you know, the models that they think look cool, which functions in a type of the game. When you're in 40K, it's about finding the actual fit. When you're in competitive 40K, it's about finding the most efficient choices and combinations. And it is more like Moneyball than it is like, you know, some 60-year-old scout on the road liking the fight and determination of a particular outfielder. You know, like it's more, you know, what can we measure about that outfielder and what's his value relative to other replacements? That's key. Or if you look at one thing I love about it's a trigger word for some people, the New England Patriots and Bill Belichick, who in an era of great parity in the NFL has essentially dominated. Each year, because his team and his coaching staff is turning over constantly, he has to look more at what are the tools he's got in his box. So what are the things he can get at value either through the draft or free agency? And what is the most optimal offense and optimal defense that he can run with those components? So it starts with what's in the toolbox and then what can I actually run with that toolbox? So if you think of an underperforming codex, for example, like Necrons, for a long time, I think folks were playing Necrons the way they wish Necrons were being could be played, right? And they were maybe doing things that assumed a certain degree of toughness or whatever and trying various tricks. Whereas now I think modern or recent Necrons lists, which have been placing well at GTs, which have, I don't want to say won a GT. I think a Necron did win.
Well, they definitely, if they haven't won, they've been 5-0s. There's been several variants that have been 5-0 in what I consider to be fairly tough fields.
And so that's happening, I think, because I think Necron players have looked at what Necrons actually are. You know, here's what we got. And from there, what can we do with it? How can we win games with what we actually have rather than what I wish we had? And I think that's a process that's going to go, going to be ongoing just as rules change. And like anyone who really, for some reason, loves Yanari for reasons beyond their rule, right? Like now you have to look at Yanari and think, okay, what can Yanari actually do? What kind of a list could actually flourish with this rule set? Because it's obviously not anything to do with what Yanari was before. And so that's sort of the mentality you have to have because it's about the game. It's not about necessarily, I mean, you can play competitive 40K with a narrative army, but if you're looking to play the game as well as you want to find and identify those most efficient choices and what can work within the constraints that you have. And that might be whatever models you have, that might be, you know, the faction you like, or if you're certain players, there are no constraints, it's just period. What's the best list I can run for the format and the situation? Yeah, I think that's what makes, you know, 40K and approaching the game.
Yeah, I think there are definite tiers to the codexes. You know, like there are some that are way better off at the service level than some others. And this is not in any way trying to shroud that or sugarcoat that. That is like the toughest pill to swallow for single faction players.
Yes,
is that, that dang, my codex just ain't as good as that one.
Right, and I think. Beyond that, though, it's also, are you even making the most of what you do have in the box, right?
Some of this stuff we're talking about like really applies to that because we are seeing people that are successful. You know, we had that talk, I don't know, a couple of months ago or whatever about what's your realistic floor and realistic ceiling about what you can play. And we find, I think the people that are operating at that much higher ceiling are always operating near their ceiling and rarely at the floor are doing this exact thing. The way they're approaching building their list is what we're talking about right now.
Yeah. And the neat thing about the dynamism, that's a poorly pronounced word there. But anyway, the way that there are so many, I'd say legitimate builds right now, I think really what makes the haves and the have-nots from a book perspective, mono-faction perspective, is how many different permutations of viable build there are. Mm-hmm. Right? I think when you look at the great books, there are a lot of ways to run Drukhari. There are a lot of ways to run Orcs. There are a lot of ways to run Imperial Guard. And that's like the most fun thing that you could ask for as someone who loves a faction. It's just like so many different ways to play with my toys. Where the bad books are, I think a lot of them have a build, you know, or they might.
You can wring a build. You can squeeze a build out of them. Yeah.
And that sucks as a creative person. I think fundamentally in 40K, it attracts creative people, whether that's from a aesthetics point of view or from the list building perspective or on the tabletop. It is a creative endeavor, 40K. And if you are given a very small sandbox for your favorite thing, I think I understand where that frustration comes from. But that's not to say that it can't be done. And also there's the, you know, wonderful, tantalizing reward of doing something legendary with something everyone else thinks sucks. Like Eric, who went, you know, and won a GT with Grey Knights in Australia. You know, like, like that is that he's a name etched in stone now because he pulled it off.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, let's take another quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about some things you got going on. We'll talk about Armageddon series and some things I got going on.
Yeah, great, man.
See you in a second.
We're sponsored by Firmaterra. With their study, lightweight and portable tables, you can make war anywhere. Please visit them at www.firmaterra.com.
We are back.
Back again.
Yeah. So let's talk about, well, you got some stuff coming up. You know, I mean, we're always truly blessed to have you on the show, and I appreciate you coming on and doing it. But you're,
I wouldn't go so far as saying blessed, but it is a, it is an honor and a pleasure to get to hang out with you, Paul.
But you know, I like to think that we help get more people interested in the hobby, but also think that we sometimes help get people interested in producing stuff for the hobby.
This is true. Yeah, it's been great to be a purely consumer, sometimes at least contributor to podcasts in the 40K realm. And recently, a little bird flew into my life, a guy named Peter Colosimo of 40kstats.com. And he started getting into the sort of nitty gritty, I guess, metrics and data of the tournament scene. And I realized that this guy who lives in the Arctic Circle probably knows more about competitive 40K as far as results are concerned than anyone else on the planet, which I find ironic and hilarious. I got to thinking about a show concept, which I thought would be really good, that is sort of underserved right now, which would be not necessarily talking about tournaments. We do it a lot. We do it on this show. We do it on other shows that I get to be a participant on, sort of looking at lists, even reading them out, breaking them down, guessing at stuff, but not a lot of the hard tournament facts. And a lot of tournaments will come and go without any recognition whatsoever. And so I got to pitch Peter and then later our friends at Frontline Gaming on an idea, which is 40K Stat Center. And the idea there is to make a used without permission sports center style, almost like highlight show, where each week we break down the tournaments that happen. All that you need to do to get coverage on the show will be, you know, be a GT. Just the same as 40kstats.com. If you're GT, which would be 28 players or higher, you have published all of your lists, ideally on BCP or someplace easy to grab them. But also, you know, if a lot of the European tournaments do this, if you just have a Google Drive with all the lists on it, you know, as long as it's accessible, we can see what players had and ran. We'll cover your tournament and we'll tell the story of that tournament. Ideally, if I can get the players to pay attention, we should have sound bites, you know, from some of the you know, higher performing players or ones with interesting lists, just giving us a quick 60 seconds on what their list was about and why it was successful. And, you know, do it with some humor and some energy. And hopefully in around an hour, we've given a good recap of the week's tournaments. And then that kicks off to all the other supporting shows like this one. Which can then go deeper, you know, just because we give that the highlights, there's so much to talk about in any given tournament.
You actually covered the first tournament in the Armageddon series, Battle for the Peak.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, we did. We did a little pilot episode through Chapter Tactics, and Battle for the Peak. We had John Lennon came on and did a little spiel about where the tournament came from and what it was all about. It was really cool. So, you know, but you didn't really, you know, get to hear everything about Battle for the Peak. So that provides opportunities now for people to ask more questions of the players that went, or podcasters to go out and get the winner of Battle for the Peak, who maybe they didn't even notice had a cool chaos list that somehow won a 5-round tournament, right? So that's sort of the goal. It's not to, it's to sort of fill a niche that I don't think is really filled right now. Not add noise to the podcastosphere. Try and add some good quality content that, you know, I find interesting.
No, I definitely think it's a value add, and people should check it out. And I like your approach to how you come about some of these things about the hobby and having it tied to something that is numbers based, performance based, or I mean, really reality based. Should be cool for people to check out.
And celebrating achievement and people doing fun stuff and celebrating all of these tournaments. Like any tournament, any grand tournament you go to that's on a weekend and has 14 or 15 tables. That's a lot of work for somebody. So, you know, this is a chance to really celebrate everybody out there who's making this competitive scene thing happen. And that's the players and the TOs. And that's what the show's essentially going to be about. And it also allows me to no longer be asked questions that I have no clue about and having to relate everything back to orcs. So that's a benefit.
Nice. Daniel Smith is actually leader of the Armageddon series right
now. There it is. Yes.
One Battle for the Peak. That's the guy with the cast list you were just talking about. And the way the series, this is a four tournament series. And it is, it's, we've been asked, and I'll certainly talk, and I owe a couple people emails about how people can get their tournaments involved with the Armageddon series. And I've got some ideas. But this is a pod. This is the Armageddon series. This is season one. It's four tournaments, the first one being the Battle for the Peak, second being Master Cities 40K, third one's the Crucible, and fourth one is the Coastal Assault. Those
Where's
are
Crucible?
Happening.
That's a big
Yeah, Crucible's in Florida.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Down in Orlando. So, I mean, a great place for you to get yourself down and then to potentially, you know, maybe get have the family to be entertained themselves while you're playing 40K if you'd like.
Not a bad twofer.
You're right. But it's also coming down. It's in the winter. It's in October. So, you know, yeah, actually, Florida's a lot warmer. So, if something else you want to get away from. But anyway, coming up June 22nd is the Master City 40K. It's in Augusta where the Masters are.
Oh, wow.
That's all why right. It's called Master City 40K.
Is it at the Hooters down the street?
Is it a brewery? That's what we were talking about earlier.
That's right.
Yeah. So the way this works, the Armageddon series works, is that it's four tournaments in a series, obviously, duh. But your top three scores contribute to who's winning the series.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to, if you were to play in all four and you really stunk it up in one, you could drop it. If you're an organizer in the series and you don't play in your own event, then you can obviously go to the other three and still compete. So that's pretty neat, if you ask me. It's set up to be to where you're rewarded for how many successive games you win, and then your modifier stops after you receive your first loss for points. So you get a quarter of a series point per battle point, and then there's a modifier that applies for until you take your first loss in the course of the tournament, and then you get a certain amount of points for winning each of your games. So and it's kind of neat that the guy who I think he was sixth in the tournament actually ended up being now he's third in the series because of that he went undefeated all the way until round four, which gave him a leg up against, you know, some of the other folks.
Yeah, sweet.
Yeah, the requirements for this has to be an ITC tournament, largely for consistency in scoring, but we also want to support the ITC rankings. If there is somehow a tie at the end of the series, the tiebreaker is based on how well you place in the ITC.
So will the winner get a belt?
Winner's going to get a medal at least.
Sweet.
Top three is going to get medals at the very least. And going over the course of the next year, going to be lining up more sponsorship stuff for people that would like to sponsor prizes within the Armageddon series and going to hand them out to some lucky folks.
Very cool.
I shouldn't say lucky. That's a bad thing. I'm going to hand them out to people that absolutely earned it over the course of these several tournaments and won it. That's basically it.
And it's just great to get anything that encourages, you know, players to move out of their immediate local area. I know down there, you know, the distances get pretty big. You know, Orlando to Atlanta is not an easy drive, you know, it's doable. And it's great to have an extra added incentive, something else to sort of bring together various tournaments to get those players moving around. And because you get to meet people from all over your beautiful country. And when you get it outside of your own country, all over the world. So
it's totally worth it.
The Armageddon series.
Yeah. And the people that are running these particular events are all good folks, the folks that I'm happy to be associated with, and look forward to grow their tournaments. And, you know, season two, our Armageddon Series UK, you know, there's all kind of things in the works.
Very cool. I also am stepping into a bit more of a give back mode with my local event, the TGX Tabletop Gaming Expo in Toronto, aka Mississauga. Much like how Adepticon is in quote-unquote Chicago, TGX is in quote-unquote Toronto. And I'll be the TO this year, taking over from Scarry. I think he plugged it last episode or whenever he was on. But he'll be running a really cool stream, doing awesome content. I'll be running 40K. You can get tickets at tabletopgaming.com. www.toronto.com. If you want to come up, Toronto in the summer for my American friends, my international friends, is a wonderful, beautiful place to be. Likely the home of the NBA champions as well. So there's more cachet. We have a very famous rapper. Come check out Toronto. It's fantastic. Play in TGX. We also have AOS. We've got an amazing Lord of the Rings event, usually with like Games Workshop. Eye of Sauron style trophy, like it's just amazing. So if you're into Lord of the Rings and you like never see events for them, this is one of them worth coming for. So check it out, tabletopgamingx.com.
Heck yeah, man! You just mentioned Skari. Skari, we had an unfortunate drop for my ATC team.
Oh, Skari's the guy.
Skari's stepping in.
Oh, nice! I saw that he was joining. I don't know if he spoiled that on his stream yet. So you might have beat him to the punch on that. But that's great. Skari is a wonderful guy to have on your team. I cherish having Skari there with me in Europe. I've played against his team in other team tournaments. He's just a wonderful man.
Now we have an international tournament, team tournament here. So
yeah. Well, hey, man. You know. I've kind of have this half-baked idea in my head. I'm just going to throw it out into the universe. In Australia, they do the ATC. It's the Australian Team Championships, but they do it by region. So it's like all the states send an eight-man team or eight-person team to go play in the ATC. And ETC is by country. And I thought, well, why wouldn't North America do like a like province and state-based tournament? We got 10 provinces up here. You got 50 states, I think. You know, get them together, you know, but that's a lot of teams to potentially come.
That's a lot of arguing. The ATC is largely a club-based thing. So you show up with your, you know, it was club versus club. And I think that's probably the best America could hope for as far as organizing how we send our people to places.
Dream bigger, baby.
Hey, look, man, you know me, I'm about it. Like if it works, it works. And
this is, by the way, no means a shot across the bow of the ATC. The club based format is awesome. ATC is probably the last like real bucket list tournament for me.
It's amazing.
So like it's, I will get there someday. It's the best format. I think they're sold out now. Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. So like that's going to be a huge event. It's going to be super sweet.
Yeah. Over 500 people playing 40K, not counting what everything else is happening.
Yeah.
There over the course of the weekend. I don't even know what I can talk about as far as like what they're going to have. I don't know. I don't want to spoil anything. You're not going to hear it from me if you haven't heard from them, but it's going to be good stuff. And, this is absolutely one of the crown jewels of 40K tournaments, and people should make it. And just wanted to mention that I'm happy to have Skari join us on our team, and I absolutely get just a stellar team. I mean, every year we have, but I think this year we have positioned within 8th edition a really good team. It really sucks to lose the guy that we did this time, but life gets in the way. Actually, it was actually a good thing. It was good things for him, which is why he couldn't come to this. And so, you know, it just happened. That's the way life works. But really happy to have Skari be able to slip into that spot for this year.
But you know, as a 40K player, no matter how good that news was, he was like, yay, yay.
Yeah, that's it. Like, oh, man.
Also, no. Yay.
Yeah. I know with an absolute heavy heart, he came to the team and explained what his situation was. And of course, we support him. I mean, there was never a question of trying to get him to alter that. Like once things go in that direction, you just have to move into it. But really happy to get Skari with us.
Yeah, and Skari's no scrub. You'll have a good time.
Yeah, we should be all right. Yeah. So that got that. Got some different things coming up too. I mean, I know this is a little bit of a pitch segment here, and I don't always like to have those, but
I liked all the pitches. I'm keen. I think they're all great. I think
they are. They're good.
Again, series all the way. Yeah, 40K Stat Center. None of these things cost you money, people. You know, just check them out. Except for the tournaments, in which case you do have to pay for those. But it's very reasonable.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been reading 5-star reviews that we get. And definitely not Josh left one that I'll just let that be.
Okay. Is this on iTunes?
Yeah. But and then other places if I see them too. I don't always get notifications of the reviews. But please continue to leave those. That is one of the ways that people get to have the show circulate to them. Or it may pop up and like, hey, somebody said they like this. You might like it too or whatever. It's just it's to help get the stuff out there. And we really appreciate people's continued support to explain to people who can listen to us. Yeah. Good, but it's no life after the cover save, but still a strong 5 stars. I'll take it. Look, man, take it wherever I can get it.
That's cool. That sounds like it may have been someone from the Life After the Cover save, and I'm just impressed that they're listening to a podcast of this quality.
So again, as we see these reviews out there, certainly continue to read them out, and any feedback we get to the show for stuff like that, it helps us, and it kind of keeps us. That's kind of our hobby fuel of hearing these kind of things for doing as long as we have.
And it helps out them algorithms too.
That's exactly right. That's shamelessly asking because it helps out the algos, but definitely also does the heart good seeing this stuff come in.
Amen.
Yeah, man. Expect some more stuff. Not slowing down. Gonna have. I've been kind of bogged down with work and doing some travel, but I don't have any of that on the foreseeable future right now. I'm gonna try to take it a little bit easier going into the summer. So expect some more hobby stuff coming out on my Instagram, Fights with Dice, and my Twitter @Warmaster_TPM.
Heck yeah.
Well, Val, thanks for joining me today.
Absolute pleasure.
Yeah. See you guys next week.
Baby in the corner.